you could spend a moment with some remarkable people and discover what their life sounds like, what would you ask? Welcome to Are We On Air? An audio encounter. I'm Armand Nafei, and each episode will feature one conversation with an inspiring friend of mine who will share with us the soundtrack to their life. Hello, beautiful people, and welcome to another episode of Are We On Air? Are we on air? This week's guest is the man about town, the DJ and music connoisseur, A-Side. Born and raised in London to Nigerian parents and now living in Los Angeles, A-Side is a music head with a taste and knowledge of all things music. Some of you might recognize him as part of the hip and fashionable musical trio and label No Vacancy In, alongside the designer Tremaine Amory, former guest on the show, and Brocky Marciano. I met A-Side a few years ago when we were both DJing at the Prada Double Club in Miami during Art Basel. And we bonded over, you guessed it, music. It's not often that I get to hear real good, unpredictable and eclectic music at these kind of social events. And to no surprise, A-Side has stories for days. He's worked and collaborated and befriended some of the greatest artists of our generation. Be it Frank Ocean, Kanye West, aka Ye, Virgil Abloh, or A$AP Rocky. You name it, he has stories with all of them. We met up over a glass of sparkling water at the Chateau's penthouse terrace, and we talked about the birth of No Vacancy Inn, meeting Virgil Abloh through Virgil's cousin and the owner of the legendary Soho record store, Deal Real, testing the Yeezus LP with Kanye at La Bodega Negra in London for the very first time, and of course what his favorite records are, and so much more. As always, you can keep up to date with our programming of our Kioskotheque in Los Angeles on our Instagram at Are We On Air and watch this full video interview on our YouTube and Spotify channels. I do apologize for some of the not so perfect audio on this one, but you know, the sound of Sunset Boulevard. What can you do? On that note, much love and I'll speak to you soon. All right, A-Side, welcome to Are We On Air, finally.
Thank you. I don't actually know what this... I think I have an idea. It's about music, right? And records.
You got it.
I've listened to a few, but it was a while back, so...
Oh, nice.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, yeah, my pleasure. Already had your partner in crime on the show as well, Tremaine. I was like, come on, we need to have A-Side on the show too.
Yeah, no, I know. We just actually spoke and he actually said it's one of the better things he's ever done.
Really?
Yeah, he said that. He literally just said that 5 minutes ago. He was like, oh yeah, no, it's just about music. So he's like, you'll enjoy it. I was like, okay, cool.
Nice. Yeah. Well, we love hearing that. Well, we're not at Coachella. We're here in Hollywood still.
Yeah. It's not a bad site, is it?
No.
The penthouse of the Chateau Marmont is never a horrible place to spend a late afternoon.
Let's talk about the soundtrack to your life, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
But before we dive into, you got to tell me that story again, how Frank Ocean's mom drove you to Coachella. We were just chatting.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, he won't mind me saying this because his mom's really cool. So the one and only time I've actually ever been to the actual Coachella festival. I mean, I've been to Palm Springs every year and kind of hung out and, you know, done that whole thing of just not going. But I went once and I was so brutally scarred by it. But there are a bunch of us staying at this, I want to say it's called La Horizon. It's like a spa hotel.
Uh-huh.
And a bunch of people showed up for lunch, including Frank Ocean and his mum. And his brother, rest in peace, Ryan. Lovely kid who passed away, unfortunately. And then it was time to leave for the festival and it became like a kind of car share situation. And there was one particular individual I didn't want to get in a car with because he was being so boisterous. It was Kanye. Well, that was his name at the time. And I was just like, I think he was drunk or something. I was just like, I don't want to be in a car with him.
What year was that?
It was the year that I believe Guns N' Roses played and the year that A$AP Rocky played. 2019, mm-hmm. It was off for a year. Was mm-hmm. it off for a year, Coachella?
Yeah, COVID.
Yeah, it was so off for a year.
I think Guns N' Roses must have been before.
Yeah, so it was
2019.
So, yeah, so there was 2021, yeah. Which did Beyonce do? So yeah, it would have been 18 or 19. And then Frank's mom kind of took pity on us because she could see that we didn't really want to get in a car with certain people because they were just a little bit too lit. And then she's like, I'll drive you guys.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, yeah. So we drove and he actually played me what was to become Endless, the album he released shortly before Blonde. And kind of just like we just spoke about it and stuff. So it was a really cool journey. And he's actually a super fun guy once you get to know him. Very shy, but, you know, when it comes to music and art, he's definitely very open. But yeah, driven to Coachella by Frank Ocean's mum. It's a true story.
Tick. I love it. I love it. What could I do to know you better than I do now? What can I do to love you more than I do now? What can I do to know that time? What can I do to show my love? What can I do? Well, another true story. This is how we know each other for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time we met, we were both playing for Prada in Miami. Mm-hmm. And we were playing, they were different areas.
Yeah.
We were playing simultaneously. And then I was done at some point and I went to see you guys, you and Tremaine, playing in the attic of yeah. this place. And I was like, wow, who are these guys? I love the sound because it obviously spoke to me.
Yeah.
You play very eclectic and soulful, and I was like, all right, let's become friends with these guys. And here we are. But so tell me, how did you start? Where did you start with? What's your earliest significant musical memory that shaped you as an artist?
I mean, I remember this because it's just this, it's kind of embedded in my memory. And it's just this true part of what I am is that I discovered my dad's record collection. My dad was one of those African men who went to university in the UK, which is how I was born in the UK in the first place. But I just assumed that in the 70s, the only real way for young people to consume music was you had to buy records. Mm-hmm. And then I'm trying to think, there was a lot of Motown in there. So a lot of Stevie, there was a lot of kind of like, I would say, funk, disco, pop, soul, like Chic was in there. I remember that. Mm-hmm. Sister Sledge was in there.
Yeah.
People like Cliff Richard. There's a really interesting slow tempo Cliff Richard record called Green Light, which I used to play all the time. She produced quite a Tony Visconti. He produced
really?
Chloe records.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So Tony Visconti produced a Cliff Richard album, which is actually not terrible. I mean, it's not amazing. But I just remember, like, there were a bunch of records and I would play them to death, and then my dad's records. And that was really, yeah, my inception point of like, but even earlier than that, I got told that I was obsessed by music even earlier than that. But that's when I genuinely remember the records and being able to touch them and feel them and play them and stuff. So, yeah. That was that time.
Well, we're definitely going to play that Cliff Richard track.
Yeah, it's called Green Light. It's pretty good.
There you go. Searching for a green light. Looking for it all night. Using all my keen sight. Searching for a green light. I know it's very difficult because you have such a broad spectrum of a sound, but how would you describe yourself in three tracks?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it depends what day it is and where I am and what mood I'm in. It's like a drug in a way. You're constantly searching for another level of excitement because there are certain records that give you a kind of weird shot of adrenaline or make you feel calm and at ease. And in some ways, I think I'm addicted to search for that feeling records. So that's why I'm looking for new sounds and new records to kind of take, or old records that I don't know already.
Mm.
But I think that, like, there are certain specific records that, like, no matter where it is or where I am, when I put those records on, the feeling returns. And trying to pick up those up. The Stooges down on the street. And not necessarily because I'm a bigger Stooges fan. I'm really not. Kind of found out about the Stooges via Iggy Pop, but, you know, kind of worked backwards, right? I also love punk, and I also, you know, love Nirvana, and then when you kind of trace it back, you kind of recognize that, like, the fundamental roots of that kind of way of sounding, it's pretty much, like, rooted in that Detroit,
absolutely.
Stooges, MC5, Def, those kind of bands, right?
Also with Nirvana, because I just saw this clip of Dave Grohl, how he explains he was basically in Nirvana as a drummer, just sampling a disco.
Yeah, for the drum breaks. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was really fascinating. That Stooges record is just so raw and so brutal sound. And it sounds unique because when you listen to modern music now, people are not really that free with the music they make. Mm. It sounds like a bunch of angry young dudes in a room just not giving a fuck. You know, but there's something about it that even rises above just being like nihilistic. It's performance art. And it's really, really an astonishing and exciting record. It just sounds so exciting. That's the thing for it. It just excites me when I listen to it. You know, it literally sounds like a car crash played out in the studio. it's pretty fun and brutal. And just like, and it's funky as well. And that's the other thing that I think that a lot of people don't understand about like early rock and punk and stuff is that these guys all, like Dave Grohl was just saying about the disco, but these guys only listen to like the same records that like, you know, were basically the fundamental records that formed soul black music.
And it's also always this like 20-year gap as well, like 20 to 30 years, because that's when they are grown up. So right. They grew up listening to this because that was just in the environment.
Right.
So their references, even if you look at our 70s heroes,
right,
they will reference people from the 50s that were their heroes. Or even Warhol was obsessed with Hollywood glamour,
right,
but of the golden age, right? So he was trying to replicate that in the 70s.
Right. Okay, so that's a pretty old record. they're trying to figure something in between then and now that makes me feel good that I return to. You know, it's so weird because the records I used to be obsessed by, sometimes I do go back to them and they just don't have that feel anymore.
Yeah.
Like you've played them too much. Yeah. Does that happen to you?
All the time.
Where you're kind of like, oh.
But there's certain tracks you go over and over, and we're talking about like over 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. There's certain tracks that you can go over and over and you don't get tired of it, or you can listen to it with a couple of months differences. Like in 12 months, I can listen to this again and obsess for a week over it again, right? Yeah. But then there's certain tracks where you just, that was just the capture of the zeitgeist. That was just the moment where I was obsessed with it and I can't listen to this anymore.
Yeah, that's the perfect way to put it, to capture the zeitgeist. I think, yeah, there's also kind of like a weird metaphor between like music for me and like actual relationships and human beings.
Mm.
Like, you know, my favorite records are not my exes, some of them.
Ah.
You want to kind of go back to, because you think you're going to go back to like that place and that time.
Yes.
Like you've forgotten why you're not together anymore. And then you kind of like hook up again and you're like,
rose colors.
Right. You kind of exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Nostalgia at its best.
And then you get there and you're like, this isn't as good as it sounded when I was like 17 or whatever, or 21.
Yes.
So yeah, there is that with records. I think the second record, and so that Stooges thing is actually a record that I'm excited about, not because I knew when it came out, wasn't even live.
Yeah.
It was more to do with the fact that when I heard it, I was like, oh wow, this is the foundation of like a lot of what I like about like funk, punk, hard rock records. Like this is the foundation of it. Like I understand where a lot of the guys who I really like were coming from. But another record I really admire, and it's hard for me to say any three records, but I'm going to try, is Talking Heads, Once in a Lifetime.
Mm.
And the reason is because I like the records I think I most like, or the ones I most love, they're kind of mysteries to me.
Mysteries?
Yeah, they're mysteries. Like I have no idea what's going on and have to kind of do some work as a listener so I can enjoy it, but I don't necessarily. So when I was a kid and I heard Once in a Lifetime, I had no idea what was making me sad. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, it's like people tell you what the Beatles is and they play you the record and you see them on TV. Kind of pretty much figure out like, oh, that's a guitar and that's a drum and that's doing. We're Talking Heads. I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. And that really like the internet. I guess it's because Brian Eno had a specific way of producing them where they were using like kind of almost like loops and they were playing over it. So they were playing like a band, but they were using the studio as a band.
And this is pre-digital, right? This is all analog and already years ahead.
It was just specifically something that they'd figured out. Then also not knowing that they were ever influenced by like fellow Kuti and Afro rhythms, which is something that I grew up with because of my family and my parents. but not actually knowing, like, I think Brian Eno actually forced the talk in this and listen to the fella.
For sure. I had David Byrne on the show as well, and we talked about it also. It's his label.
But the reissue label.
It's all world music. So-called Brazilian, world music. Yeah. That's his, passion. Passion, yeah. You know? Talking about Kuti, also had Sion Kuti on the show.
That's the thing for me. So, like, I could relate it back to those records, and then, you know, once I could relate it back to those records, I could be like, oh, man, the Afrobeat thing, and it's sort of like whatever futuristic sort of loop studio techniques that were like people still working with music. And the fact that Dave Byrne wasn't even really singing, it was kind of this kind of weird, like, crypto rap torch. Do you know what I mean? It was like the whole thing was just like a jumble that just really made sense and was kind of perfect and unique.
You may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife, and you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here? Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down. Letting the days go by, water flowing underground into the blue again. After the money's gone, once in a lifetime, water flowing underground.
And then the record, the third record, I think, is just like the godfather of it all for me, is James Brown.
Ooh, yeah.
Our favorite game to play when we get tipsy around music, guys, is like, who's the most important musician of all time? Very hard for anyone to suggest that's anyone other than James Brown to me. Pretty much all of hip and dance music is kind of based upon the James Brown template.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's the blueprint.
He's the blueprint.
Yeah. Right?
And so, really, when you look at like modern music, there was music before James Brown and music after James Brown.
100%.
That's literally how you.
100%.
It's kind of like, you know, how they talk about biblical
there's
figures
no Prince,
or whatever.
There's no MJ, nothing.
Yeah, there's nothing. There's no disco.
Yeah.
There's no funk.
No.
There's no hip-hop drums.
No.
And, you know, even Kraftwerk, you know, in an interview, you said they were just trying to copy James Brown, but because they were like white German guys and they couldn't do funk, they used synthesizers instead. And, you know, now Kraftwerk are the blueprint of modern dance music.
100%.
So James Brown is the guy. So, you know, There Was a Time by James Brown contains everything there is to love about James Brown. It's hard, it's funky, it's dirty. The screaming, it's shouting. The band sound like they're playing for their lives. You know, at the right time, or the right party, or just the right set, and that record is just, you know, you've got a Sex Machine, and you've got, like, some Madness Man's World. You got this, you know, James Brown is very prolific. Mm. But there's something about There Was a Time. You know, the live version or the studio version, it's just, like, it's an incredible record.
Get down! To be the boss, paid the cost to be the boss. I paid the cost to be the boss.
So yeah, Stooges, James Brown, and Talking Heads.
Very good choices. Very good choice.
Thank you.
Well, talking about choices and good taste in music, let's talk about No Vacancy. And what is No Vacancy in? Where did it start? Where is it going? And what song defines No Vacancy in for you?
Yeah, I mean, I met Tremaine in London and we kind of just plotted it. He was like, oh, you smoke? And I was like, yeah, you smoke? And we started smoking and talking. But yeah, the actual pod was music, actually, all honesty. So they started spending a lot of time in my apartment in London. I lived in London and just playing records that you maybe hadn't heard. Or, you know, for me, vinyl was still like the litmus test for how good a record really is, for a bunch of reasons. But obviously, because, you know, especially with recording, live recording music, when it's pressed to like a piece of vinyl and, you know, the right system picks it up, you'll hear it record. Yeah, that kind of became our relationship. And then from there, from hanging out and going out a lot in Soho and East London, you know, we kind of became this duo, became known for like, no, Tremaine doesn't DJ and he makes such a, you know, thing of it. Like, people always say, oh, can you two DJ together? And he's like,
I'm the MC.
He's like, there's no one ever actually looked at the thing. Like, I don't touch anything. Like, he doesn't DJ. And I've actually said, like, if I wanted to really make some money, I'd give up, just let him do it and just kind of be the puppet master.
Yeah.
Because I think people want to see Tremaine more than they want to see me, because I'm just the guy who just stands there, just like, leave me alone when I'm DJing. I'm very much a leave me alone kind of DJ. But yeah, it became like a sort of hangout for us to just express our taste in music and style. And then I became like, you know, by default, big people just wanted to hang out with us. So we started getting to do parties in East London, and we started to get to do parties in Soho.
That was the Mexican place, right?
Yeah, it was called La Bodega Negra. Still La
Bodega Negra, yeah.
Yeah, I think I looked into it. Like, I was in London in the summer, and I tried to go in, and it was so bad. It was like pedestrian. It's like going into like, what's the name of the place that's opposite?
Pink Tacos.
Yeah.
No, Pinches Tacos. Pinches.
No, Pinches. Pinches is fun. Pinches has got good food. This place doesn't even have good food in. It was just like, it was just like bad West End. Yeah. So, but it used to be a super fun place and the reason it was good is because Serge Becker, who is the guy behind
Miss Lily's
and the other
RRP, La Esquina in New York,
and also was an old school DJ,
he's been around for, yes,
music guy. He was one of the main.
Serge is the OG, one of the OGs, New York OGs, right, in nightlife. For
and
sure.
He's one of the, a shout to Serge. He's always been really lovely to me and to Tremaine, old friends of Tremaine. But he basically was one of the driving forces behind opening the Mexican place in London.
Yeah.
And so his whole, you know, sort of way of looking at things was like, well, the food always tastes better if the people are sexy and there's music playing. So it's like,
that is so true.
So he kind of just added that to like the overall feel at the place. And because then I ended up DJing a lot, Tremaine was always there. And people just started booking us. And then at one point, I think we just turned around to each other and you just said, look, and you know what? It's all good being kind of friends hanging out and kind of getting like, asked to do this and asked to do that, you know. But Tremaine was working on Mark Jacobs at the time. I was kind of like finishing a record, not a duo band thing that I'd call the Asharelli. And I was just like, look, if we put a name to this, we're going to go a little more violence. Probably going to just seem more official to be. Do you know what I mean? You know, like when people want to book you for something, if they're like, come on, hey, do you want to do this gig? It's like $1,000 or whatever. And you're like, yeah, sure. But you know, the minute you go, oh, yeah, it's an email to send it to somebody. And then you don't have to deal with it anymore. That person can ask for like whatever.
Exactly.
And you're just like, it's got nothing to do with me, man. It's like, you know what I mean? So No Vacancy was like a fake way of like, kind of like making sure we come with money. It's basically like a sort of fake LLC. No.
But then eventually also you guys branched out into
we started making merch. The merch was just like a kind of interesting way to kind of like commemorate some of the parties we were doing at some of the events and some of our friends and Virgil. And it kind of just grew into this thing naturally between London, New York, and LA. You know, I spent a lot more time in LA, Therese with Wilk originally, at West London. It's definitely been a huge part of like what I've been doing in the last 10 years. But, you know, it's ever more so than never changing. So, you know, it's what it will be, you know.
Yeah.
At one point, we were sort of at a record label.
Mm-hmm.
But then that's kind of like the most kind of naff waste of time that could probably do in 2020, whatever year we're in, 2023, because it's just, it's, I mean, you've got to really be committed to start record label with that place, right?
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
It's not, you're not going to press a bunch of records and sell it.
No.
Go back and do it again. It's a different beast. So, but yeah, No Vacancy, it's been a fun ride.
And what track defines the sound of No Vacancy?
Oh.
In one track.
You have to ask Tremaine that. He's really good at like quick.
Well, we did ask him. Really, I'm sure the answer
is. Responses. No, it won't be the same. I don't know. Honestly, I'm trying to think. Like, you know, it'd be something really hip hop, but like something. It'd be something like T.I. All About the Money. And I think the reason to be that record, ironically, is because that was the record that when we first came to LA. Again, I don't want to name the date because I really can't remember. I want to say 2018. Came for a Stussy event. It was stayed downtown in LA. And that record had just come out. And hip-hop was going through that weird phase where I think it was T.I. and Young Thug made that record to be about that. It's a really good record by him. Like, honestly, it's really, really good. But it was still going through that phase where, like, and the most interesting phases of music for me are always when the people who are making it sort of aren't really clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sort of experimenting. But so it's like, it's such a sick record. It's produced by London on the track. So it's got like a crazy groove and like these gospel sort of like keyboards and stuff. And it's not like a trap record. It's actually theory. It's when they used to put bass lines in hip hop records, it's about just like bass sounds. And I'm getting a bit technical and I should play, but
great. Yeah, please. I want to learn.
Because when they used to have guitars on records, rather than having people on stage lip syncing.
Coachella. In my day, you couldn't lip sync because there was nothing to sync to.
You are sorry.
No diss, no diss.
Well, I wasn't there, so I don't know what I would be referring to.
Jeez. Wow. Okay, so yeah, a TI about the money. There you go.
All right, there you go.
Yeah. Don't be blowing me up, nigga, I ain't getting up. If it ain't about the money, ain't no use to you ringing my line. Stop wasting my time. If it ain't about the money, nah, I can't even hear what you say. I ain't finna do shit. If it ain't about the money, bitch, you can miss me with it. Bitch, nigga, miss me with it. Turn it, turn it, turn it. I'm packing 11, I'm packing 11. I boom, turn it. I'm riding a gator, my shoes are Giuseppe.
You briefly mentioned Virgil,
yes.
R.I.P., who you guys were very close.
Yeah.
When did you guys meet?
Ooh,
what was the plan? And what track defines Virgil for you?
Oh, wow. Hey, let me try to answer that as best as I can. I first met Virgil again. Date's terrible. What I do know is the first time we hung out, it was a nightclub involved, but it's called the Double Club.
Yes. Yeah. I played it, you know.
You played at the Double Club?
I curated the one in Miami. The 10-year anniversary.
Right, there you go. So the one in London.
In London, I was just
right.
A guess.
So when was the 10-year anniversary?
2017. 2009 was with Carsten in London. And then 10-year anniversary was, I think, 17.
So we were at a Double Club.
One of the best places
London.
Ever.
Yeah, the one in London was amazing. Yeah. So that, yeah, it was a Prada in Gaston Holler.
Yeah.
Prior to that, there's a gentleman called Tony Tager who ran a record store. Saw some intertwined. He ran a record store in London with some business partners of his, and it was called Deal Real Records, which had previously been another record store called Deal Real Records that the owners, I think, sold to Tony. Tony's Ghanaian, British of Ghanaian descent, grew up in London, had this record store, and his record store used to host hip-hop nights, which, funny enough, like Freestyle MC Nights, which is where A-Track actually met Kanye and became Kanye's DJ.
Oh, wow.
Amy Winehouse used to hang out there, the streets used to hang out there. It was like a really cool vibe in Soho in London. But I bring up the store because Tony Tago mentioned to me when he said, oh, you'd really like my cousin, you should meet him. I think you two really get on, and this cousin happens to be Virgil Abloh.
Oh, wow.
That was like, so Tony's British and Virgil's American, but they were related. And I didn't know what I was talking about. And then, excellent unity. You know, Kanye used to come to London a lot, which is how I met him. And basically showed up with Virgil. And we just spoke about everything.
Yeah, over a decade plus, just became super tight and super friends and just kind of ended up always in, you know, in different countries around the world, working or hanging out or doing stuff, you know. But there was never really a plan, you know. I think Virgil had his own plans and he executed them, as we can all see. And we kind of just watched him do it. And we were very kind of proud of him and always like, all inspired continuously. But I think if I was to find a record that exemplifies who Virgil is to me, it's kind of a hard one because he's so many things. But I think of us all together in London. There's memories of so many parties that were amazing. But there's a James Blake record that we all... Basically, it came out and I remember playing it and like they'd all come down to hang out at La Bodega Negra and they were leaving because they just like, oh God, it's too busy. And I think they all turned around when that record started playing because it was just like... And that was the night I remember that Kanye first basically tested out Yeezus in the room for people.
Wow.
And it was deep. It was special. Because not only were they kind of demos of the record, so they weren't finished. You know, you were hearing different lyrics that ended up on the actual finished album. Like, I know a lot of people hate Yeezus. I think it's probably the best album Kanye West has ever done. And it's pretty much up there with a lot of albums for me. But, you know, especially in London in that period, and he made it between London and Paris, and you could kind of hear that in some of the textures.
Mm.
But I think the whole of that album, Yeezus, really represents, like, for me, the friendship that we all had and we continue to have, because, you know, we were all in Europe, we were all hanging out, everyone's figuring out where they were going to go in the future, and like, you know, even though certain themes in the record are quite dark and paranoid and angry and it's still a very fun record, and we just had so much fun. And it's a nighttime record.
Yeah. I am a god. I am a god.
I am a god.
I am a god. Hurry up with my damn massage. Hurry up with my damn Minaj. Get the Porsche out the damn garage. Even though I'm a man of God, my whole life in the hand of God. So y'all better quit playing with God.
I don't remember ever hanging out with Virgil at the beach. Like, I don't remember.
I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, I don't remember ever hanging out, you know, we were in Miami probably at least 20 times, and I don't think we ever hung out at the beach once. Like, I think I pretty much...
I can just see all of you on the beach.
Yeah, standing in the beach. Like, and it's like Star Trek. Like, how did we get here? Like, were we beamed down? No, we hung out in nightclubs.
Yeah.
And like, and then and in studios, and in, you know, artist studios, and in design studios, and in music studios, and nightclubs, and in bars, and restaurants. Those were the places that we hung out and we socialized. So I think, you know, users for me is... And also, you know, he called me in for some of the sessions. We were all just like very actively.
Yeah,
it was a crew. We were actively involved. And I remember going to like Ye's house in Paris, and it was just like the craziest, coolest little like sort of like studio slash apartment slash what the fuck is this guy got, like a caboose here, kind of like whatever, like centerpiece with like a drum machine on top of it, you know, like just like wild, wild, like kind of interesting lifestyle that these, you know, these guys were living. And you know, and I think that record is also quite a complete record in a lot of ways. Like, it starts off really kind of like kind of angry and dark and sarcastic, and then, you know, and there's a lot of information contained with it about the kind of like if you really think about certain things like New Slaves and what Kanye said in that record, and you relate it to like even the fashion industry and stuff, which, you know, Virgil was a part of, and a lot of those guys help promote as well. You can really see the sort of like the connection, you know. It's kind of mad when you really look back on it that way. But then you also get to the end of the record, and it's like something like Bound is just like a love song, you know. And Virgil was already kind of deeply in love with his wife, and Kanye was, I think, either getting married to Kim or they just got married, you know. So like, I think for me, that record really represents all the sides of like that world and who these guys were when I met them, you know. It's probably the best answer I can give you.
That was a great answer.
Yeah.
Honey. All the mother niggas lame, and you know it now. When a real nigga hold you down, you supposed to drown. Kanye just happened. I was thinking, how would Virgil reacted to this? Or was this thinking, seeing all this happening publicly? Because Virgil was, in a way, even though he was so out there in public, he was also very, I think, always in thought and more shining inwards rather than out. So there are certain things that were out there, which was very work related by himself. It was kind of private. And then seeing how Kanye went the complete opposite, I was kind of curious, because they had an interesting relationship as well.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to like speak on behalf of someone,
of course,
you know, and to kind of like try to assume how they would react to a situation. But I think those guys' relationship is definitely like a complicated one, and it's something that only they could really understand. Kanye's Kanye, man. Like, you know, the thing about him is it's just like what he says and how he thinks and what he does are sometimes simultaneous, and sometimes they're really at odds with each other. And I think people are going to find the part that speaks to them and stick with that.
Yeah.
People are going to find the part that repels them and stick to that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah,
he's
sure.
Like a polarizing figure,
absolutely,
right? And
yeah.
And maybe he relishes that more than he should. I don't know. But I think that, like, because of that, you know, when he does and says anything, it gets taken so far beyond the context of what he's saying, and it becomes like this. But, you know, people have to also understand that, like, artists aren't politicians, man.
Yeah.
Like, do you know what I mean? If you like, I mean, politicians are barely politicians at this point. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? They're kind of entertainers.
Entertainers becoming politicians. Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's like, and I'm never going to excuse someone else's, you know, what someone else says. Sure. Or like, it's not my business to do that. Yeah. Like, what he says, he has to own it and live it, and that's his point of view.
Yeah,
this is. I don't have to tell anyone if I agree or disagree unless they ask me personally, because I didn't say it. So, do you know what I mean? It's like, why would I have to give an opinion on it beyond like...
No, you shouldn't.
Yeah, right. But I think that, like, I think that Virgil was a very loving guy and he was a very open guy. And I think Kanye is too. That's the irony of all of this. I actually don't think he has any hatred, you know, really deep down in his heart for anyone of, you know, from any background. And I think that, like, as we... the world that we're in now, because... you know, people have to understand stuff like about music and art. Like, over the years, there's been some of the controversy that artists from previous generations went through. They wouldn't survive in this day and time.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't be given a chance. Yeah. But the difference is now...
different cultural awareness.
We're just in a different time. And people will just take whatever you say. And then if you're doubling down as well, it doesn't help. So it's just like, as I said, I can never tell you how Virgil could feel or react. I just know that he was just a really loving guy and he was just cool with everyone. That was what was amazing about him. And he was actually, in a lot of ways, one of the most neutral people I ever knew. You know, he's kind of like Switzerland most of the time.
I love that.
Do you know what I mean? So
I've used that the Switzerland thing and the neutral for a lot of things as a example.
It's funny, but Ye is not Switzerland.
What's the opposite of Switzerland?
Let's not go there. Let's leave that one to the historians.
Well, going back to the music.
Yeah, there you go.
Let me help you to dig yourself out of this hole.
Yeah, there you go.
We had our Are We On Air kiosk here a couple of weeks ago during Oscars in LA, and of course wanted you to DJ, but you weren't in town. You were on your way to Ghana.
Yeah.
I love Accra. I love Ghana. There's a lot of great energy coming out of Accra and Lagos as well.
Yeah.
To the world. I mean, it's always been there, but the world has woken up to it. We're talking about the art scene is thriving.
Yeah.
The music scene is thriving. Design is thriving. I mean, the pulses in world culture are coming out of the African continent.
Yeah.
So tell me, what's happening? What's cooking? What's hot? Any artists that we need to listen to?
Honestly, I was there for such a short period of time. Oh, it's 4 days. We were in and out. Like, it was pretty rock and roll. Yeah. Like, we went there to work to shoot a Marnie campaign, but like a Marnie No Vacancy campaign.
Oh,
but
nice.
I mean, I want to get back as soon as possible. I think, you know, the amazing thing now for me, you know, there are parts of like the internet and like, I guess, kind of like unlimited access to like information via your phone and your computer or whatever, your smart thing, is that sometimes it's just like you can kind of see where it's just not helping us as people, you know, like it's not progressive. I think it's holding a lot of people back. A lot of thoughts have been formed in weird ways. There's basic layers of addiction happening. But then the other flip side of it is, it's like you don't even need to necessarily go to another country now to know what's going on there. Like, you know, we are in the most plugged in and tapped in time in history to have access to like what people are doing. And it's really interesting because the youth, you know that, like, you know, Africa is like, I think something more than 50% of Africa's population is like around the age of 20.
Mm-hmm.
They're young, man.
Yeah.
It's young, you know? So like, they're just going to do stuff, you know? And when it comes to art and music, those guys are doing stuff and it's like, let's put it this way. I think that, like, America, you know, due to its kind of vast geographical spread, and Europe to an extent, have always pumped out like a lot of music. Right now in America, Africa, what's happening is unparalleled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about so many different variations on sound. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I went to see Carl Craig play at the Mocha on Saturday.
Interviewing him tomorrow.
So I want to, I want to see him play the Mocha on Saturday night, and he probably played about.
Wait, you were there on Saturday?
Yeah, I was there Saturday. Too. Yeah,
I went to see Moody Man, and then I had to head out. But
No, after Moody Man, Carl Craig jumped. He was great. He's incredible.
It was amazing.
Yeah, it was a beautiful night. But he played about at least half an hour on a piano, you know, which is South African kind of house, slowed down again, and like a really, really, really beautiful pulse and stuff. And I was just like, wow, like this is the. It's like a Detroit legend.
Mm-hmm.
And he's played African house music. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a really, 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 like, really cool just idea that that's even happening. Really, right.
Yeah.
And so for me, I mean, to answer your question, I couldn't tell you anything specific that I found, but I need to go back and just... But one thing I do know, and from even when I was there, it's just moving so fast. You know, because as I said, it's like over 50% of the population in Africa are pretty much around the 20 years old mark. They're making stuff, man.
Yeah.
And I want to explore more and really, really hear and see what people are doing. So, you know, maybe I'll be able to come back and kind of update you. But yeah.
Please, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's happening there.
Yeah.
Not to wrap up, but to go slightly more intimate, what's your go-to falling in love or heartbreak song?
Oh, wow. Damn. You know how hard these questions are?
Come on, baby.
They're really, really hard questions.
The first thing that pops into your mind. Boom.
Oh, man. Falling in love. It'd have to be like some kind of Michael Henderson record, maybe. I love Michael Henderson. You know, he's like a session player, bass player in the 60s and 70s. And then he did like... really beautiful sounding. I'm really obsessed with, there's a particular sound I'm obsessed with lots of sounds, but there's a particular sound I'm obsessed with, which is just like, you know, friends of mine will come around and I'm just like, please, can you stop playing this music? And it's like this kind of weird mid to late 70s soul sound that specifically came out of California. A lot of it was produced by like Quincy Jones.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of like Rufus Records.
Yeah.
George Benson records, Gimme the Night, which are kind of more popular things. You know, Patty Austin, who worked with Quincy Jones on a lot of backing vocals and vocals. She did a bunch of, but there's like a sound. So there's like a Michael Henderson record called Let Me Love You. Going Places is the name of the album. That entire album for me, that's just like driving up the PCH, Malibu, falling in love, sunset.
Love it.
Beautiful. Beautiful record.
That's the best thing about LA. It's exactly what you just described. Yeah. Top down, down the PCH.
Yeah. That's it. That's it. It's like, it doesn't matter, you know. And yeah.
Believe you could let me in your heart. Let me love you. I plan to do us both good.
All the records from that period, pretty much, even the ones that Quincy didn't produce, you know, things like, so on the flip side of that, my heartbreak record would be like Rufus and Shaka Khan's Stay. It's on the album Street Player, I think, which also has a song Street Player, that is a Chicago song as well. But that song is heartbreaking. It's Shaka Khan at her best, strings, slow, LA, blissed out. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Shaka Khan, Stay. Yeah.
And then after the heartbreak, when you're out and about in town, driving down Sunset Boulevard in your car, feeling super sexy. What's the sexiest song?
Oh, we're back to Shaka Khan always. Shaka Khan and Rufus, Any Love. Any Love, dude. That's just, for me, I mean, honestly, I'm obsessed by that sound in that period. And that record is so beautiful. And Shaka Khan is, luckily, she's still around. She's just one of those performers that, like, you know, it's funny. I was looking at my record collection today and for no reason, I think I was looking for something. I was trying to find a record and I end up looking and I realized how many records I had by the same bands or the same performers. And I always knew it, but something just struck me about that. Like how nowadays, you know, it's almost impossible to get like 5 albums that you love by the same band, you know? Like that's becoming a rarity, which is kind of sad, you know? Like I'm not a Coldplay fan at all, but I was like watching a YouTube random thing about where did Coldplay go wrong? And it's like they're on a
dive deep into this. Like,
and it's like they're on a 6 album. It's like they've done 6 albums. Yeah. Like they haven't gone wrong. Like do 10, do 20. So, you know, I really love the fact that like I can have like 8 Chaka Khan albums and Rufus albums that I love. Do you know what I mean? And they're all really good and they show the growth and they show the, you know, the kind of maturity and it's just different sides of the band. But yeah, Chaka Khan and Rufus, man. If I think I was just had to make a choice and just like go with just like, okay, this is what you get to take out of the house, I would go with those.
Well, A-Side, to wrap up our little chat, if your life would be a movie, what song would play in the end credits?
Frank Sinatra, LA is My Lady.
Oh!
Thank you, man.
Thanks for being on air with us. Thank you for tuning in this week. If you want to listen to the full playlist, visit areweonair.com or our Spotify channel. You can also find us on Instagram and on YouTube at areweonair. And a big thank you to my wonderful team at Studio Noi. I'm Armand Nafei, and I'll speak to you soon.